As you've told me, everyone is here. This is Chris Benjamin's class on Honesty is Not the Best Policy. And as most of you have told me, the title has brought you in here. It's very provocative, which tells me you're either wanting to see how a guy can argue that honesty is not a good thing, or a lot of you want to know if you can get away with lying.
Yeah. Or both.
Maybe both. Maybe we can. I will tell you this. In working on this, I've decided that the title might be better at this point to say policy is not the best policy. Now, if you look, there's a clue, and I didn't put it up here. I said honesty is not the best policy. Okay. This quote, you've heard it before. Honesty is the best policy. Okay, we've all heard that in some form or fashion before, and it goes back. It's ancient. It's thousands of years. And you understand the gist of it, what it's trying to say. It's trying to say that in all things, if you will just keep integrity and be honest, that is the best way to conduct yourself. That is the best policy in all things. I'm not going to argue against that. In fact, I'm going to support that. All for it. So if you were sweating thinking that this guy was going to make a case for being dishonest, no, that's not what we're going to do. But I am going to say that we sometimes get into habits, policies. We sometimes get into habits as a people that keep us from being honest. Let me get oriented here. Another thing, I tell you, some of you said you came in here because the title. You thought the title was interesting. I wonder if one of those reasons was because of the word policy. And how many of you work in organizations where policy is very helpful or a part of what you do? Yes, as some helpful policies. All right. How many of you work in organizations or groups where policy tends to get in the way? Okay. All right. And if nothing else, and by the way, there were more hands that came up than not for those of you in radio land. And the if nothing else, it tells us what our gut feelings about policy are. And that's the origin of this title. That when we reduce honesty and our ethics down to statements that can be lined out in a policy, we're going in the wrong direction. We've got to turn that around. I've spent 5 years on a city board, and we had to make decisions there. And sometimes we were guided by policy rather than by common sense or higher principles. But because we were a body put into place by elected officials, we were bound to follow a set of written policies, and we would be accountable if we did not. And there's good and bad in that, as you can well imagine, because if we were held accountable to the written code, we had to do what the written code said. We knew we would be held accountable to it, that people could use that against us, but this was keeping everything fair. But it was really hard sometimes to just use honesty. And I thought that coming from a church, I was quite the opposite, because here I am, I'm a preacher in a church, I'm a leader in a church. Surely I don't have to I don't have to follow all these rules. We had rules where we had to keep everything in the press, we had to keep everything very transparent. And I thought, in church we just sort of do all that naturally. But that experience taught me that sometimes we don't do it as naturally as we should. And I don't intend for this to be a church bashing session or anything like that. I believe that well-intentioned people do their best efforts to try to communicate in a church family, but sometimes we act as if, and this is why I'm saying we need more than policy. Sometimes we act as if policies or committees or written codes, written procedures, we act as if that can do the job better than we can. And I tend to believe that people guided by love and oriented, with God's Holy Spirit, we can do a better job than putting things down on paper and acting as if that is somehow a power that we are all accountable to. So let me make a few observations for us to think about when it comes to policy. First of all, policy can become a power. Okay? I hope that some of you have done different readings on what... we're starting to be aware of this now, that when Paul talks about the powers and principalities in the epistles, he's talking about things that... He's not actually talking about governmental powers, although that could be included in the list. But he's talking about anything that can rule us as a people. It's a super personality. It's something greater than all of us. And I'll give you a few examples of those so you can think through some of your own. You remember, maybe it still happens, but people will talk about... I remember we interviewed people during a holiday event that we were having at our congregation in Fort Smith, and we kept asking people in the community. We were doing a giveaway, and we were sharing things with people in the community. And one of the questions we would ask them is, we said, what is it that would make your life better in the next year? And they would say, almost everyone would say, well, if the economy gets better. The economy. When you put that article, that specific article in front of economy, the economy, you've made the economy into a power. As if it has a personality and a whim all its own. It's capricious. It can decide if it's going to be a good year or a bad year. The stock market can become a power. Anything that's larger than us but isn't really a personality in and of itself, those are the powers. Policy can become that sort of a power. When we write policies, when we put together policies, and we act as if those policies, we are all somehow more accountable to it than we are to one another, I would say that policy has become a bad power. By the way, one of the things I would point out about powers, and I've learned this, they can be both good and bad. And like everything else in this universe, they need to be redeemed. They need to become obedient to Jesus Christ and to his authority. So powers, we don't just want to get rid of powers. I don't know that we can. But we want to redeem powers. So when we write our policies, because I don't think we'll ever be fully rid of them, we want to, at least in the church family, we want to redeem those and we want to submit those to Jesus Christ. Policy can become a power. And when it does, it can be used by people who want to manage power. And sometimes bad policies empower people who do not need to be empowered. Because one of the things, you've probably seen this, and you know, if we start telling stories on this now, it's all going to get very personal. And this is being recorded. And we want to be honest. But policies, think of the word, require that someone must police that policy. And one of the questions to ask as you go through whatever organizations you're with or maybe your church family is ask yourself, okay, who polices this policy? Because you can put something in a policy statement and it's a great idea. But who's going to do anything about it? Over the years, I've become a collector of policy statements. And I have some of my favorites. One of my favorites is this. This is a building use policy that says, if you have a running track, everyone must walk or run in the same direction. Okay, now you can understand the intent behind that. Mm-hmm. The intent is we don't want people running around the track colliding into each other. You have collisions on the running track. But you got to ask this question, who's going to police that? Furthermore, which direction is the right direction? I mean, you know, if you start enforcing that, you're going to end up with factions. You're going to have the clockwise crowd and the anti-clockwise crowd. Next thing you know, one group who believes in anti-clockwise, they're going to move down the street, start a new congregation. Want to know what the elder's position is on running on the track? Which direction is right? And sometimes policy can get to the point that in some ways you have to out-legalist the legalists, okay? Years ago I was involved in a policy decision, and again, van policies, whenever we're using our vans and our resources at churches, we get very concerned about these things. And they were writing a church policy to keep the vans clean is essentially what it was doing. And so this long list, I'm being asked to read it and give my thoughts on it because at that time I think it was thought that I understood the minds of young people. And anyway, the It was like no red candy, no sticky candy, no gum, no red soda. And I kept thinking, well, you know, but, you know, if I did understand the minds of young people, I'd be one to say, yeah, well, it's not red, it's purple. You know, so you didn't say purple. You know, I'm not thinking about what really stains or anything like that. I finally edited the policy statement and put a big circle around the whole thing, and I just said, no food or drink. And the reaction I got from some was shock. It was like, oh, we can't be that blunt about it. And I said, well, look, you've just got a choice to make. We either say no food or drink, or maybe we can turn it into a positive statement and say, look, if you make a mess and you make an accident, own up for it, clean it. And just be direct. But policy has this way of being indirect and, here's your other P word here, passive. Okay? And it avoids the real issues. Which, by the way, when you're passive, you are avoiding a certain quality and characteristic that we're going to talk about. Anybody want to guess what it might be? If you're passive, you're going to be indirect and you're not going to come to the truth. So you're going to be less than honest, exactly. And that's where this is all going. Honesty would be better. Not a better policy. It would just be a better way of treating one another. Policy also takes personalities. It does some interesting things when it comes to personalities. We like policy for all the wrong reasons. And one of the reasons that we like policy but we shouldn't is because policy tends to take all the personalities out of the equation when we're having to make decisions, when we're learning how to treat one another, when we're learning how to share the things that we have in common. By the way, if any of you are writers, if you know any writers, this becomes stock material for sitcoms and movies. You know, it's always, you've got the roommates who can't get along and they have to decide how we're going to divide up the food. And it always inevitably ends up with the masking tape down the center of the room. That's your side of the room and this is my side of the room. And then one guy gets very smug and he says, ha ha, that'll teach you. Yeah, but the bathroom's on my side. Uh-oh. And, you know, see, policy. Okay, takes the personalities out of it. So you can get some good material out of this. And here's the thing I want to ask you, though. If this is true, if policy could really take personalities out of the equation, how many times, just in your own memory, how many times have you dealt with bad policy and it took all the drama out of the conversation? Has that ever happened? It rarely works, does it? In fact, most policies have at their root a story, okay? And that story, if you're going to do some work on policy after this, let me encourage you. Go find the stories that exist behind these policies, okay? You will get some of the best stories. If you're a preacher or a teacher, you will get great stories. There will be some story of, you know, it's like, this is the strangest thing, you know. Why do we have a policy against power tools? Well, let me tell you, one time this guy came up here with a drill and the story will just go on from there. But you'll get some great stories out of that. And usually it's one code breaker, you know, one law breaker that did all of this and the rest of us are suffering for it. But at least redeem the policy by getting the story out of it, okay? It's worth it for that story. I'm going to contend that this doesn't take the personalities out of the equation. In fact, what we need to do when we're making decisions, instead of removing personalities and people from the equation, let's put that back into it. I want to tell you one of my favorite stories about policy, and this is a good story, a story I appreciate about our congregation back in Fort Smith, Westark. We had a policy, like most churches do. We're not unique in this. A lot of churches tend to have policies, and they'll go back years, about when and where and if you can use instrumental music in your church building. That seem familiar to anybody if you're in Churches of Christ? Okay, yeah, it's there. So we had an interesting one by the time that this issue got raised, and it was you can use, here's how it went. It was you could tell it had been adapted, and you know, over time it had been changed. It had a lot of masking tape, duct tape on it, and so it said you cannot use actual musical instruments in the building. Okay, Now, actually, you could. This was an unwritten policy, but you could in one place because it was built after the year 2000, but in the other place, it was verboten. We actually joked about that. But you could use recorded instrument of music.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, so yeah, the kind of the compromise policy. But because, because here's the deal, is that, you know, when they roll the banjo out, it just scares people. Okay, and you know, it's like, oh no, and what's next? There'll be dancing bears before we know it. And we had a family. Now here's where the personalities come in. We had a family, and they were planning the most amazing wedding. Two sisters were getting married on the same day, and this wedding was so wonderful that they actually appeared on the front of our little local advertising magazine in Fort Smith. You've seen those? And I mean, there they are. This is, in fact, I'm in the background. I'm way in the background on that cover, and I'm blurry. I'm kind of like the little guy in Monsters, Inc. I made the cover, you know, and there I am back there, that blur. And so this is a big wedding. And of course, they said, look, we know you've got a policy on instrument of music, but we have a friend, and she plays the harp, and it's beautiful, and we've always wanted her to be a part of this. But we won't cause a problem. Personalities come into it. Their personality is good. We won't cause a problem. You know, we understand the policy. And I'm so thankful because our church leaders, our elders, they said, no, wait. Give us a chance to think about this first. And they sat down, they started thinking about this, and because, you know, they love this family, and this family's got a good attitude, but that's not all of it. They really stopped and thought. They said, well, why do we have this mixed up policy? You can, you know, it's kind of hypocritical. You could have recorded music that's instrumental, but you can't have an instrument. What? How does that work exactly? They finally decided in all things not related to the Sunday morning assembly, They simplified it and they said, you know, here's what it's going to be. At weddings, funerals, or other events, the music has to be appropriate. That's very vague, but there's wisdom in being vague because it gives them the right to use, and this is something we're going to talk about, discernment and wisdom. Now, otherwise, you ended up painting yourself into a legalistic corner. As one of our church leaders said, you know, as it is, what you can do is, you can't have a harp playing Amazing Grace, but what we could do is we could have a recorded version of, with full instruments of All My Rowdy Friends, you know, are coming over tonight or something like, I've got friends in low places or whatever. You fill in the blank. But we don't have any specific policy against that, and this made it much more appropriate. Because now the personalities and the wisdom factored into it. Real people had to say, is that the best thing to do right here and now? And the idea behind it is it will partner with people. I know it was the right decision in this case. When talking to the two couples that were getting married, I said, you know, you've got this fantastic wedding that you're planning. Tell me why you want to have it here. And one of the young men who was getting married, he said, because this is where we grew up. This is our spiritual family living room. I was baptized here. We grew up here. We studied here. I want to be married here. I want to remember that this was the place. And it was fantastic. That's an example of good policy. And I'm telling you, when you have to do policy, bring the personalities into it. We also think that policy simplifies things. And as I hope we've just pointed out, the truth is it doesn't simplify things. It does simplify things at first, because it reduces things down, but it simplifies things for all the wrong reasons. And what it starts to do, it's bad simplification, okay? And what it's doing is it's reducing everything down, things that don't need to be reduced down, to machine-like choices. I become very interested in the AIs, the artificial intelligences that are moving into our world, and we're starting to share space with them. And don't get worried about that. I don't wear a tinfoil hat or anything like that, okay? But part of this just comes from my frustrations and my argument. I'll confess this. I don't get along with Siri very well. And I need to do something to make it up to her, but I tend to think that she doesn't care. And most AIs are like this. I will say this to rental car companies. If any of you work in rental car companies, if any of you listening work in rental car companies, when someone has an accident in a rental car, do not put, you know, the number that you put out there that says in case of an accident, it should not go to a chat bot, okay? It should not go to an artificial intelligence that's having to listen to you. I had this experience recently back in January. So I'm having an accident. I call the number. I get it's a fender bender, but you know, car plows into the rental car. So I'm thinking, oh, you know, I'm feeling bad. I mean, my shoulders are all tense. So I'm calling in. Hello, I see that you're calling the helpline for accidents. If you've been in an accident, press 1. If you just need to call and talk, press 2 or something like that. You know, starts going through the menu. Please listen carefully because menu options have changed. And how many people call in, you know, this accident line? But I don't have my glasses. I can't see. So I don't want to push buttons. My muscles are tense. I just said, I've been in an accident. Get me an operator. I think you're trying to reach an operator. If that's true, press 1. If not, press 2. So I start playing around with the robot at this point. And I just said, I'm bleeding everywhere. Would you please get me an operator? It's horrible. It's horrible. I think you want to talk to an operator. But first, if you would answer a few simple questions. You know, press 1 if you've been in an accident. You don't understand. I don't have the use of my arms. Get me an operator. And on it goes. And then I just start furiously pushing the number 0. And I think I broke their system and somebody answered. It's not good for us to learn to talk to machines. Okay? Now, if you're in the business and you like this, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against technology, but, you know, I like it. But really, and those of you who are developing machines that talk to us, we've been sold a bill of goods, okay? I want to encourage you to continue in your work. But, you know, we've all seen Jean-Luc Picard talk to his little machine, you know, to his computer, and, you know, hey, computer, and the computer understands. Tony Stark and Jarvis have wonderful chats, you know, and Jarvis understands everything that he ever says. Our AIs can't do that yet. So keep working on it. I want to encourage people, because when it gets to that level, it's probably going to be better. But in the meanwhile, having everything reduced down for all the wrong reasons is not making us good people. Yeah, because it's throwing out honesty, discernment, and wisdom. Okay, a machine can't tell if I'm lying to it. A machine can't tell if I'm playing games with it. Oh, it can. You know, there's some algorithms that could be written, and I understand that all this could be improved, and I know that, you know, eventually they'll pass the Turing test and all that. But that's not my point right now. I'm not so much worried about how we talk to machines. I'm worried about what it does when we start talking to one another. And I'm wondering if there's an effect there. Last summer, we went to Scotland, and I had this moment where I was realizing that there was some difference in talking to a machine versus talking to a human. You think you should know that all the time. Yeah, but I actually came to the grips with the fact that I don't pay attention. Because we go through life interacting with machines, interacting with automated voices, you know, websites, and we just click on boxes. If you're my generation and up, you might be one of those who says, yeah, I wish there was a real person I could talk to. You know, you don't have to be old to want that. Sometimes it's good. But you go through customs, and everything's tense, and you're thinking, me at least, I'm thinking about everything I've ever done. And I am smuggling stuff into the United States at this point. Okay, I'm going to admit that. It's legal, though. It's legal. But I know I can get in, you know, I know that somebody will ask questions. I've been to Scotland, and I've got 2 cans of haggis. Okay? So, don't make fun of haggis. All right? You hear a lot of jokes about it. It's all right. I mean, if you eat boudin, you know, I mean, I don't know. That's worse. But so I've got these 2 cans of haggis. Now, I know that they're good. I know that I can get them through customs because the people in the airport in Scotland told me so. And then I thought, wait a second, maybe they're just selling me this because after I leave the country, what do they care? But no, I know it's good. I also know it's canned, and I know that I've done it before. Okay? As long as it's canned, it's okay. But when I get to I get to a customs kiosk. And it reduces everything down to yes and no. And it says, are you carrying with you any agricultural products, any food products? Yes is the answer. That's the correct answer. But I can't explain that yes. And I'm thinking too, Jesus says, let your yes be yes and let your no be no. But I'm also thinking, do I owe that allegiance to the truth to a machine?
Do I? Or do I owe it to myself? Well, I know the answer. I know what will happen. But I go ahead and I click the yes. Yep, I've got it. I've got canned meat products.
When I go through the line, and there's a person, and she's asking me questions about it. She says, I noticed you clicked yes. And I said, here's what it is. I've bought this, brought it in before. She says, it's okay. Now, I told her the same answer, yes, but I spoke it to her in the context of understanding, of discernment, and wisdom. I'm not saying we shouldn't be honest or, you know, again, I could have tricked the machine. I could have acted like I knew more than the machine. The test on the machine was not a test of the machine. It was a test of my integrity. So one of the things that would help us if we could move honesty away from all of this other stuff is that we would begin to appreciate honesty more. Some of you may be familiar with a book by a fellow named Patrick Lencioni. It's called the Five Dysfunctions I can't think of the title right now. It's Five Characteristics of a Dysfunctional Team or something like that. Anyway, Lencioni talks about dysfunctional teams, and one of the things that he says is politics. Okay, that's our other word up here. Politics, and we can kind of wrap a lot of this up, which is related to policy. Politics is what you get when you choose your words and actions based on how you want others to react rather than on what you really think. So, when we choose our words, trying to get a particular reaction out of other people or trying to modify their behavior rather than what we really think, are we being honest? There's some situations where obviously you have to help people modify their behavior. If you're a school teacher, I don't know that it's necessarily good for you to tell the students everything that you think. Okay? There will be lawsuits. And again, it's not that you have to be dishonest to avoid that. Okay? Jesus says don't throw your pearls before swine. I'm not saying that students are swine, but I am saying that there's a place for wisdom, that we get to decide what should be said and what should not be said. But obviously you have to say some things to people if you're a leader in any capacity, if you've been asked to lead a group. You need to say some things, you know, that clearly modify behavior. I mean, but you don't have to veil that. If we do such and such, then we will be rewarded with this. You know, if we do X, then we can expect Y. Is this something that we can all agree to? You don't have to veil that. Preaching, the whole point of, sometimes, one of the points of preaching, I guess I should say, is that you want people to examine their lives and think about what they're doing and hopefully make some changes. You want them to be better people, better disciples of Jesus. Now, you don't have to be tricky or, you know, carrot in a stick and all of that. You can just put it out there. I mean, you know, Jesus obviously is teaching us. He says, your righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees, or you're not entering into the kingdom of heaven. That's a good thing to enter into the kingdom of heaven. We want to do that. And Jesus is putting it out there very plainly what we have to do. But when our words are chosen to get a particular reaction or behavior, rather than to reflect what we really think, Lencioni says we're moving into politics. In Matthew 23, Jesus has seven woes for Pharisees. A woe is an expression of distress, regret, disappointment, grief. Jesus is not just attacking them to bring on a battle, to be combative. But he's expressing a real sorrow over the state of affairs. And if you read Matthew 23, the state of affairs with the Pharisees is that they've become so burdened, and they have turned the truth of God into what you might say is first century policy. Okay? Because they've focused on minutia. And again, as a collector of policy statements, one of my favorites there is how they have tithed out of their spice rack.
which, you know, you get this image of someone who is so concerned about giving a tenth that they go through of all their goods, and spices are valuable commodities, and they are measuring out what they have there, and they measure out a tenth of that. And then they give that to God. I've kept my vows. I've followed the policy. I've done what I'm supposed to do. But then Jesus says, the problem is you've neglected weightier matters like justice and mercy. Those would be much better things to focus on.
If we are not focusing on honesty as a virtue, as a way of life, then I think we may be in line for a woe. And although we're not going to, I don't think many of us are going to be tithing spices out of the spice rack. I'll tell you where I think, and I've noticed this in myself, and I'll give this to you. This is your little self-test. The way it shows up in our speech, that we're focused more on policy, politics, we're focused more on personalities or being passive or powers, there's some cues that you can pick up in your language. And again, I don't want to get into minutiae here and you know, make everybody think that you've got to get these things out of your life, but pay attention to these things and you might start noticing a better way. Sometimes we say is that honesty is brutal. Why do we say that? What is it? Why would we ever think that something like honesty, if Jesus says, let your yes be yes, let your no be no, anything more than that comes from the devil, then why on earth would we say that honesty is brutal? Over against this definition of politics, where we're trying to get people to do what we want or to behave how we want, the other side of that then, if you're saying what you really think, the other side of that would be what? Honesty. Shouldn't honesty be refreshing? Shouldn't honesty be, you know, shouldn't it be good? Have you ever had a heart-to-heart with someone and you thought it was going to be very difficult, maybe you even sweated about it for days, and when it was all over, it's like a big burden was lifted for you and for them. Honesty can be liberating. But we tend to act like it's brutal. And then sometimes we're proud of that. I'm just going to tell you the honest truth,
as if the truth is anything but honest. There's word cue number one. Like, give me the dishonest truth. Okay. We'll figure that out. I'm going to give you the honest truth. And you're not going to like it. It's going to be toe stomping. Oh, yeah, I'm going to have to step on a few toes. And you're going to be wounded after this, and you're going to be hurting. But it's the truth, and I'm giving you the truth for your own good. Why is anybody going to stand for that? You know, I'm going to preach the word. You're not going to like it, but it's going to be what you need to hear. Okay, I'm leaving. You know,
I don't see the Sermon on the Mount phrased that way. And then we keep it real. That's the new way of saying, I'm just going to keep it real. I'm just keeping it real. I'm just telling you what I think.
Keeping it real is not a license for being rude. Okay.
There's still a place to be honest and genuine about respecting others. Here's another denial of honesty and the denial that honesty is possible. You will read that we as human creatures are born liars. That it's in our nature.
Now, you know, we can talk about the sinful nature. We can talk about what it is that makes us fallen and broken. But just to assume from the start that everyone is lying, that everybody's veiling something, that may be a condition of this broken world. But if we are so cynical as to think that we can't arrive at a place of truth, then why are we even trying? I think that's what causes us. Even, you know, I can understand that we may say, okay, let's leave it to the world to treat one another that way. You know, as Jesus said, the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over one another. They like their hierarchies. They like their ranks. They like their policies. But you're not so with you. Not so with you. That's not the way it's going to be in the kingdom. Okay, so we have to believe that in the kingdom, right here and now, not just the heavenly hereafter, but right here and now, that it is possible for us to embody ways of truth. I think that what's going to trip us up is we're going to think that we have to do it perfectly at all times. Don't fall into that trap. We need to strive for it. And if we change our expectations instead of right, you know, I think we have this expectation, and this is where the policy becomes a power, that there's going to be kind of this golden policy statement that falls out of heaven, you know, maybe written on tablets of platinum. And you know, or it's on a hard drive of gold, and you know, and it will liberate us, and you know, and we will be saved, and you know, we are a people of the policy, and we think that if we do that, then that's going to take all the human drama out of it. We're going to be better. But if we would change our expectations and say that this is a fantasy and this isn't going to happen, but what is a reality is the stuff we often think can happen, and that is that we can live truthfully with one another. That we can live openly with one another, that we're not born liars, that we might be broken and that causes us to lie, we might be afraid and that causes us to lie, but we have to have a confidence in the Spirit that we can become more mature and disciplined. And that it is honest to be possible all the time, and those excuses that cause us to think that we can't be honest means that we're running away from a few things when we say, well, you know, you can't do this all the time, you can't be honest all the time. I'll accept that if you're saying it's hard to do that all the time. It is hard. But I want to point out that when we say that, and I've said that, what we're running away from is we're running away from the hard work of discernment and wisdom. Which means people have to sit down and you're going to have to sort some things out. And it may not be easy, but the result is going to be much better. We're running away from the discernment and wisdom. We're running away from the idea of integrity, that somehow it isn't possible to maintain this, or relationships. You see, this is the harder part in all of this. It's one thing for me to be worried about how honest I can be to a machine in the customs line. That's between me and the machine. And the machine doesn't lose sleep over that. But when I think about that honesty and working with other people, and I don't know what they think, and I don't know how they're feeling, and we can't figure out everything about them, then that becomes much harder. And we have to do this work here. We can't read their minds, we often say. Well, I can't read somebody else's mind. Don't buy into this idea that there will be a utopia when we can all read each other's minds, okay? We already have that. It's called Facebook, and we don't like what we're hearing from one another. So it hasn't made us love more. If I only knew what you really think. Okay, never mind. Keep it to yourself. In relationships, you have to become responsible for your words. You have to own what you say, and you have to own it in relationship. It's easy to put those words on a piece of paper and then just float it out there, and you can put your name on it or not. It's easy to throw a thought out on, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, or Instagram. Well, Instagram, that's you know, people don't read Instagram. But you put all that out there, and you know, the thought, it's out there, but it's something you don't have to own later. But if I have to sit down with you and work with you and own that and say it in real space and in real time, something changes. Now, Jesus seems to think that we can do this, that we can be these sort of people. In the Sermon on the Mount, when he's preaching on the way we live, one of the ways that we live is that our yes is yes and our no is no, and it can be simple, and that can lead us. Now, when we have to go back to the table and write some policies, because there are, I'm not denying, there are times and places we're going to have to do this. Mm-hmm. And what we'll do is maybe we'll come at it from we'll understand that policy is a tool meant to serve people, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be very honest about things. We'll inform people. Good policy will tell people what they need to know. And we'll be guided by principles like honesty. But I do want you to know that honesty is a basket that contains many things like relationships, your own personal integrity, the processes of discernment and wisdom. And you have a part in contributing to those processes of discernment and wisdom in your families, in your organizations, in your religious networks, your spiritual networks. And I want to encourage you. I think that one of the ways that the Spirit redeems our fellowships is he teaches us how to speak to one another. We say these words a lot, in truth and in love. And sometimes that becomes code language for beating people up, you know, religiously. I'm just going to lay out the truth in love. And, you know, okay, that's right. But if we really are committed to that, then it's going to look like maybe an imperfect process, but it's going to be a good one. All of us have been the beneficiaries of handmade things. You know, maybe you've got a picture on your refrigerator. A child drew that picture for you. Maybe you have something that somebody gave you, a gift. Maybe somebody in your family knits and they gave you something. All of these imperfect things that you've gotten, even if it's a piece of furniture. And sometimes, you know, I've made arts and crafts and drawings, and I can always see the imperfections in them. And they annoy me. But the people who receive those gifts love them. Because it's not just something that they grabbed off of a shelf. It means something to them. Mm-hmm. Okay, this way of honesty and discernment and wisdom, it may not be perfect. But this is going to be organic relationships. This is going to be handmade DIY relationships. This is the kind of stuff that you're going to be so proud of that you're not just going to go post it on the corner of the internet like policy, but you're going to put it on your refrigerator wall. And you're going to love it. You're going to enjoy it. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate your kindness, your attention, and your wisdom. Let's go and be honest people as Jesus told us to. Thank you again.